Hey, this is Hal Hester. I'm the pastor of Vineyard Christian Church, and this is our podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today. I hope this message inspires you, builds your faith, and gives you perspective on how God is moving in your life. Please enjoy the message.
Well, good morning. I hope that you are all having a wonderful morning. To all the mothers, I want to say a special good morning to you. I hope that your morning has already been very sweet, maybe including some pancakes or something like that this morning, or something wonderful, but glad to see all of you here. One of the things that we do here on Mother's Day is kind of one of our traditions. We don't have a lot of traditions around here, but one of the traditions we do have is that on Mother's Day, we have some chocolate that we would like to give to all the women of our congregation this morning. And so we've got some teams that are going to be just passing around some bars of chocolate to all the women, and if you would make sure and get your bar of chocolate as it comes along, just our way of saying thank you for being here this morning, glad that you are with us and how much we appreciate you. Also want to remind everyone from Mother's Day to Father's Day, we do an outreach each year in which one of the ministries that we support, one of our missions, is our A New Generation. And helping moms and dads and others in moments of crisis pregnancy when things are unexpected, and trying to minister to those families in a way that brings hope and wholeness. And so one of the things that we do each year from Mother's Day to Father's Day is we have some baby bottles out there, and we're asking if you would take a baby bottle. We only got like 20 of them left. They took most of them last week, and a few went this morning as well. But if you would grab one of those baby bottles and then just fill that up. You can fill it up with change. You could write a big fat check and stick in there. That'd be fine. You could stuff it full of dollar bills, which, you know, or $100 bills. What I'd love for you to do, if you would take some time and put some money in that and give toward that ministry. I know that they do fantastic work in helping families, and I know that you'll be blessed for doing so. And so would like to invite you to take time to do that on your way out. And then, if you would, make sure and bring those bottles back by Father's Day. You can bring them back sooner. You can bring them back full tomorrow. That'd be great. But you can, if you would, make sure that they get back here by Father's Day. We're going to continue our series in Esther this morning. We're in Esther chapter 3, if you want to be turning there. Esther chapter 3. You know, as you're turning there, I'm reminded that in Genesis chapter 11, we meet the father of faith, Abraham. Now, he's first introduced to us as Abram. His name hasn't been changed to Abraham yet. But the introduction is brief. A man living in Ur of the Chaldees who was told by God to go to a land that God will show him. And in that brief introduction, we not only find out a lot about Abraham, what kind of man it takes to trust God in that moment, but we find out a lot about the nature of God. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, well, you know, I mean, we live in a very transient kind of society. In fact, if you think about it, we're the third largest nation on earth, and most of us, our families came here as kind of pioneers, or came here in some way in which they were being torn away from their families and going to a foreign land and without much chance of returning to that land. We have built our nation in that way, but that is unusual in the way that things work. If you go to Europe, if you travel around the world, you find that most people settles in some place and stay there for centuries upon centuries. And many times, millennia, family have resided in the same place. It's why we have an understanding of ethnicity and things like that, of language and culture, the way we do, is because it is normative for people to go and to stay. It is not normal for people to uproot themselves and move away from everything they know, everything they understand. And so there's something that is unique about Abraham, and that in a day and time when people rarely moved about, that he was willing to go to this place simply on the promise that God said to him, "You go and I will show you the land. When you get there, you will know where you are." It's profoundly challenging and makes us begin to understand something about the nature of his faith for him to do what he did at the time in which he did it. It also speaks to us about the very nature of God, and that how he has designed us and put us together, and this whole thing of how God relates to us, sometimes calling us into places that are not what we expect, asking things of us that we were not prepared to deal with. Trusting God true faith can often be very difficult for us. In part, it's because what the Hebrew writer says, that many of the heroes of the faith went to their grave without seeing the very things come to pass that they were anticipating. The Hebrew writer says it this way, that faith is the evidence of those things yet unseen, meaning it was enough for them to trust God, never having proof, even going to their grave, but still confident that God could be trusted. In fact, it's one of the reasons why that has that statement by some who want to mock the Christian faith and calling it blind faith, because of the simple fact that the very nature of faith itself calls on us to believe when we have not seen. Now, believing, which is sometimes used interchangeably for this idea of faith, often becomes in our minds our concept of God and our theology, the things we accept as being true, when in fact, the true sense, what Paul means by, the Apostle Paul means by believing and calls upon us to believe, really has much more to do with that concept of faith and trust in God. The idea not that I believe this set of things, but I believe this set of things even in the face of difficulty, even in the face of hardship, even when the evidence doesn't line up, even whenever it calls me into places that I do not want to go. And so the God who calls us there is an amazing God who asks things of us that we do not understand. One of my favorite quotes about God is from the book The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. In it, C.S. Lewis writes about the Christ figure, Aslan, that he is a lion, the great lion. To which a young girl replies, by the name of Susan, "Is he safe?" And Mr. Beaver replies, "Safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he is good. He is the king, I tell you." You see, that nature of who God is, of being the one that calls us into deep waters and to trust him, and the very nature of what faith is really about, not just our mental ascent, but the idea that we would follow after him, even in those moments when we do not understand, even in the situations that we cannot begin to comprehend. Faith is the belief that God is with us no matter where it takes us. So it could lead us into the valley of the mundane, or maybe into the valley of death. He could take us to the mountain of the Lord to experience his presence, or across mountains, ranges of them, to a people yet unreached and unknown to us. It may be that we'll be called upon to part the sea and to escape on dry land. Or we may cross the sea in the belly of a whale to go to a people that we don't like, don't love, and in earnest don't want to see saved. We may be called upon to raise a child to know the Lord for an important moment in their life. Or we may be called upon to stretch out our hand and raise the dead. All of these things in the hands of God, whom we must trust and whom which we take our beliefs and then ask the question, do I really believe that God is good? Do I trust him when I cannot see the outcome, when I cannot scroll to the end of the story and find out how things play out? Do I trust him like those heroes of old when I myself may lay my head down in my old age and depart from this life, never having seen the outcome I was longing for? Today, as we continue our series, Living an Epic Life, here in Esther chapter 3, just like the last two chapters, there's actually no mention of God by name, nor are there any prayers to him. However, here in the most pivotal chapter in the entire book, the unfolding reveals to us that God is working through his people. Some willingly and some unwittingly to accomplish his great plans. Let's take a look at Esther chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. I'm going to read from the English Standard Version. Please follow along in whatever translation you have. The one on your lap is, of course, my favorite translation. And after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, he would not listen to them. They told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is in the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast lots before Haman day after day, and they cast it month upon month, until the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among all the peoples in the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of other people. They do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charged the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money is given to you, the people also, to do with as it seems good to you." Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the people, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces and with instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. And a copy of the document was issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king and by decree that was issued in Susa the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. Blessed be the reading of God's holy word. There is a saying that just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't actually after you. You might be paranoid for a reason. Now, I am not one much for conspiracy theories. If you've been around me for very long, you know that, I have a tendency to even kind of poke fun at them a little bit. I got a cheap generator from Y2K. And I've heard a number of them over the years. And even some of the most credible ones, I have to be honest, have typically folded under scrutiny. And still, that does not mean that there are not really people with truly evil intent, conspiring to do evil. And so it requires us to evaluate the things that are before us. We know that King Ahasuerus was not a good guy. When we start reading through the book, we quickly realize that this man is not a good guy. If we look at him from history, if we look at the Xerxes of history, we know that he was one of the cruelest rulers of all time, that he was known for using his armies to crush people, and it was not uncommon that often when he was defeating his enemies, he would send other troops around the backside to utterly destroy their families, to wipe out their families for having the audacity to stand against him. It wasn't enough that he would defeat you in war, but he would prefer to wipe out everything you love to make sure that nobody else would stand against him the next time. He was the vilest kind of ruler there could be. And so it's no surprise to us that his closest associates were also not good people either. There in chapter 1, we read about how he lost his queen through the advice of his drunk buddies who were sitting there with him and giving him advice that was foolish. We watch as they come up with a solution to get him a new queen and put these women through something that is something less than admirable in terms of a pageant, but not like a pageant like we think of in this country, a beauty pageant, but more in the sense of putting these women through the rigors to see who would please him most. I promise you that it was something truly vile. And so it should be of no surprise to us that the king and all of his associates are not good people. What should be surprising to us is that a good man like Mordecai was able to bring any influence of all, and in chapter 2, able to protect the king. And why would he? Why would he really? I mean, when we think about it, I mean, the reason he is there is because of what the Medo-Persians have done to his people. The reason he's there in that situation is because of all the things that he has suffered. There's every reason for him to hate Xerxes. There's every reason for him to have hated his father and to hate the generations of the Medo-Persians who've come up against his people. There's every reason for him living there in captivity to think differently, to not want to do right by them, certainly not to honor the king. And yet, what we know about Mordecai is this, that Mordecai is a good man who fears God and honors the king. And so against all of the things that he may feel about the ruler in his day, even though he doesn't think of him as a good man, even though he knows he's a vile man, even though he knows he's a cruel man, even though he's not a good and honest ruler, here's the thing that he has been taught from earliest days, without exception: fear God and honor the king. And so he does, without exception. It's not surprising to us then that one of the king's henchmen, Haman, isn't a good guy though. Cruel like King Ahasuerus, selfish like King Ahasuerus, Haman was all about Haman. In fact, here's the truth. Haman didn't care about the king. You see, there's no sense in him that says, fear God and honor the king. The reason Haman honors the king is the king is Haman's source of reward. The king was in many ways Haman's obstacle to overcome in order to gain self-aggrandizement, someone to be manipulated, someone to prove something to so that he could be rewarded and get what he could out of the empire. You see, Haman said what he did to the king, not because he was worried about the Medo-Persian Empire, but because he didn't like that he wasn't being honored. It wasn't because he thought this was what's best for the kingdom. It was because it was what was best for Haman. Haman was all about Haman. And so it was not ever in the interest of anyone else, but only in his own best interest. On the other hand, Mordecai is the guy who went out of his way in this very altruistic kind of way, wanting what is best, wanting to do what is good, wanting to do what is noble, honoring God. He gave the news of what was planned against the king to defend the life of the king. Understand, as we stand there in chapter 2 and he speaks those words, whenever he's working to make sure that the king is protected, there is no promise made to him that this will lead to his honor. In fact, there's absolutely no mention of his honor anywhere in the text. You see, where Haman, every time he gets stroked, where every time anything happens for him or whatever, he's quick to make sure that there's a declaration made and he's put in honor. And he's got his photo, he's taking the selfie with the king, you know? I mean, he's getting his moment of fame, right? It's all about him. It's all about his Instagram and his Facebook presence. It's all about his moment of fame. It's all about looking good in the moment, regardless of who you really are. Regardless of the fact that you don't really care about the king. But Mordecai, who has every reason to not care, every reason to want to see the death of Ahasuerus. No, he stands with him and for him. And that makes Mordecai hate him. You see, we might be tempted to think that Haman hates Mordecai because he doesn't bow down to him. But can I just point out to you that he didn't even notice? He didn't notice. Somebody else had to tell him. Somebody else had to point it out to him. See, he was busy basking in what everybody else was saying. He was basking in what everybody else was doing. There was no reason for him to notice Mordecai, what Mordecai was doing or not doing. He had every reason to just be all self-absorbed. But others were watching what Mordecai did. It stood out to them. Why doesn't Mordecai bow down? They say it's because he's a Jew, a follower of Almighty God, and they bow only before their God and their king. And so they tested the waters to see if it was true. And Haman hated Mordecai, not for failing to bow down before him, but for not being like him. Isn't it what he says? Listen to the words that he says to the king. They're not like us. That means they're trouble. That means they're dangerous. That means that they're problem people. When you're not like us, when you don't fit in, when you don't do what we do, when you don't act like we act, when you don't make the right kissy face. We don't like people who aren't like us. Haman didn't like him because he got under his skin, because he knew that Mordecai wasn't like him. And when he found out the source of why he wasn't like him, when he found out the source of what he thought was his altruism, was his faith, his inheritance, his God, his ethnicity, his people, he became intolerable to Haman. Absolutely intolerable. Because Haman's mind, warped by sin, believed that Mordecai's very existence invalidated what Haman believed about himself and about the world around him. It happens sometimes with us in different ways and times and things, but that people view us differently because of the way that we believe, and oftentimes view our beliefs, our confidence in God as being a direct threat to those around them. It's become more and more of an issue in our society. Jesus told his disciples in John 15, if the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. You know, church, if we lose sight of that perspective, it's easy in a world that competes to have everyone's attention, to have everyone's affection and everything, then to begin to lose perspective or lose confidence in the God who called us. To lose confidence in the way in which we were called and the things that we're called to behave different, to be a people who live above all the noise instead of right in the middle of it. To love the praise of God more than the praise of men. Even though the accolades of God sometimes are much quieter, it will undo you. You know, as we look across this book, the book of Esther, surprisingly enough, it's really less about Esther or Mordecai or Haman, as it really is all about God. Isn't it funny that a book that doesn't mention him, that doesn't talk about him, that doesn't call him out by name, really is all about God? See, it's all about you and I and Mordecai and Esther and all of us trusting God when we have seemingly no reason to trust him. You see, it's called the Book of Esther because she's going to put her life on the line. It's called the Book of Esther because he plucks her from obscurity and being unknown to putting her into a place of power and authority and to be able to influence a nation. He's taking someone who had no anticipation of God using them in any way in particular, and he exalts her to a great place in order to save a people and to save God's plan to reach the world. But we could just as easily call it the Book of Mordecai or the Book of Haman. It centers around their story. But in truth, it really is the book of trusting God. You see, it's like John said in verse 21, chapter 15, no servant is greater than his master. If they hated me, they will hate you. See, that's really what they hated in Mordecai. It's really what brought this cataclysmic group of events together and brought salvation for the Jews. In a world where people like King Ahasuerus reign, in a world where people like Mordecai are the enforcers, where those who recommend things to the king are only acting in their own self-interest, whatever's most meaningful to them. That's the world that you and I walk in. It's the world where Jesus walked and bought our redemption. Not in a context where things are working out the way we always want them to work out. Not in the context of how we make things happen in such a way that we find joy in it. Do you know, one of the things my wife and I were just talking about the other day, we were watching a movie and I was talking about, I know it frustrates my wife sometimes, I'm not a real big fan of Christian movies. And the biggest reason I'm not a big fan of Christian movies is because everything always works out so neatly in the end. And I'm like, when in real life did that ever happen? Okay? When in real life does that ever happen? Sometimes the guy goes up against the atheist professor and he still gets an F. Sometimes people stand up against difficulties or difficult situations and they still lose their head. They still lose their license. They still lose things and they wonder where God is in the midst of it. And see, here's the reality is that sometimes life, we just have to trust God because you and I can't scroll to the end and find out that there's an Esther. You and I can't scroll to the end and find out that there's a Mordecai or that there's an army of Jews ready to fight back. We don't get to scroll to the end and find out that King Ahasuerus is going to make a decree that will defend them. No, instead, you and I live right there in chapter 3. Sometimes with the enemy plotting against us out of their own personal wants, likes, dislikes, with no regard for anyone else. Like I said, it's not paranoia if they're really after you. And so in the context of that kind of world government, with officials like Haman and kings like Ahasuerus, that we have to walk out our faith. See, faith, belief, as I said before, is not about just subscribing to a theology, to a group of ideas, to an ideology. See, that's philosophy. Whenever it doesn't cost you anything, when there's no skin in the game, that's philosophy. See, a lot of times we're quick to rail against philosophy and in the schools of philosophy. But can I just tell you that there is just as much danger in the Christian church today where we have taken a philosophical approach to Christianity. The idea that we subscribe to these things and that makes us right, and yet we live completely contrary to that which we say we believe. It is not faith unless there is trust. It is when I believe those things and I subscribe to them, when the circumstances don't line up, when I don't see those things come to pass in my lifetime, when I'm standing in the front of King Ahasuerus under the threat of death, whenever I'm pained with the situation of having to speak my mind in a situation and not knowing what will happen, that's when it goes from philosophy to faith. It is not saving faith because you have a head full of knowledge or you can quote the entire Old Testament. It's saving faith when you believe those things and trust in those things, sometimes over and against your experience. Sometimes when everything else isn't adding up. Sometimes when your life is on the line. Sometimes when you don't see good things come to pass while you're in the land of the living. So when you're living the story and you don't know, that's the essence of genuine faith. When you have to trust and believe in the one whose outcome is in his hands, not in yours. Do you understand as we sit here in this chapter that at this point there has been no promise of God that he is going to preserve the Jews in Medo-Persia? In fact, there's no prophecy from old in which they could cling to and say, you know, we have this promise that we're going to come back from the land of the Medes and Persians. There was things about spoken about over Babylon, but never about the Medes and the Persians. And there's no promise that Mordecai was going to survive this whole situation. There's no promise that Esther would be successful or that she wouldn't even lose her head in that moment. So at this point in the story, we're struck by the fact that King Ahasuerus had no idea who is going to be affected by his decree. Remember in the first week, one of the things I told you about the laws of the Medes and Persians is that the laws were written the way they were, that they could not change the laws to keep people from protecting their own family or their own interests. It was a way to create justice. So they said, look, you know what, if my cousin Bob gets in trouble because of the law I made, this way you can't change the law to protect cousin Bob. So understand in this moment, what he doesn't know is that he's written the death decree against his own wife, the one he loves, the one that he's so infatuated with, the one that he thinks highly of. He's written the death decree against Mordecai, the guy who protected his life, the guy that he believes well in, the guy that Haman was afraid to touch on his own for fear of the king. But now he has the law of the Medes and the Persians on his side. Now he has a law that cannot be changed so that with impunity he can hang him on the gallows and nobody knows that Queen Esther, that her life weighs in the balance. They've kept it a secret. There's no promise that they're going to be all right. The king was just protecting his own interests. Can you imagine that? I mean, that the idea that somebody who is ruling would allow his, you know, dumb drunk friends to write up a bunch of laws. And then he says, here's my signet ring. You go ahead and stamp it for me. I don't have to know what's in it to pass it. You know, I mean, in fact, you know what? We'll have to pass it to find out what's in it. Oh, wait a minute. Okay. So my point just being that, you know, listen, that people sometimes enact legislation without any real thought of how the consequences are going to affect real people. The king was just protecting his own interests. There are people he's heard who are against him. There's people he's heard who will devour his kingdom. Understand that this was one of the most diverse kingdoms on earth, that every one of those 127 different provinces spoke different languages, had different cultures and customs. And so it wasn't that he was not used to people of all kinds of diverse backgrounds and things, but what they stood against, what made them distinctly different, what made them hate them was the way they were different. That it wasn't all about them and their own interests. Remember, this is the king who banished Vashti by listening to his advisors. Why wouldn't he make another stupid decision? He had no idea how it was going to impact his wife. No idea how it was going to impact Mordecai. Just bad people whose customs are not like ours. You know, some of you right now are faced with moments in life, maybe where you're being pressed, crushed, persecuted. Maybe not just like Mordecai, but maybe just like Mordecai, you don't even know why. You may believe it's because it's just that boss you don't like and you guys don't get along. You may think it's because your ex is just an angry person and she, you know, or he. And you might think that your teacher, the teacher doesn't like my hair, my style, my personality. And in your mind, there could be 1,000 reasons why they don't like you. See, in a generation like ours, it's always consumed with getting more likes. Sometimes it's really hard for us to see behind the things behind like and dislike, or to recognize what's really at odds. And just like Mordecai, you see, it doesn't say it in the text, but you and I, we might be tempted to complain to God about how we've been a good person. You might be angry with God because it's not fair. And it's not. As long as there are Ahasuerus, as long as there are Hamans that rule in this world, life will not be fair. You will not vote it into fairness. Don't kid yourself. You will not vote it into justice. We live in a fallen world. And so we might be tempted to complain. We might be tempted to ask, how could there be a King Ahasuerus and his dumb drunk friends who govern the world? We might complain, God, how could there be a Haman if you're a good God? And look, listen, you and I can't scroll to the end to find our salvation. We can't find out if there's an Esther on our behalf or whether it will be the dawning of the end when God's hope and your redemption will come near. You can't scroll to the end and find out. You have to trust God in the midst of it. Because you don't know what Esther's going to do. All you can do is trust God. Continue to do what is right. Believing that he who is God of all will one day right the scales of justice. That one day he will judge the living and the dead. One day he'll purge the earth of evil. But what about now? When you're in that place of where you're being tried and you're being tempted. Tempted what? To take the shortcut? Tempted to solve it in your own way? Tempted to do things or to go along to get along? And you know, when you're in that place, no one will blame you. It's part of the deception, isn't it, of the enemy? He tells us no one would blame you. You're just doing what everybody else would do. And when you're in that place and when you're tempted to sink or to give in, when you're tempted to go just to get along, I want you to ask yourself a question. I think it's an important question, especially on Mother's Day. Who is going to raise Esther? Who's going to raise Esther? The young woman who was plucked out of being a nobody and ascended to the throne. And that moment, everything, she could have caved into all the situations. But here's what happened. She grew up under a Mordecai, who was the same every day, whether he was standing at the king's gate or whether he was in the presence of his home or he was in the presence of his God. He was the same person every day. And she grew up under that kind of leadership in her household. You know, one of the saddest things to me in ministry over the years has been to hear the stories of either church leaders or pastors and their children tell about how home life was so completely different from church life. What dissonance it created in their heart. How it made them hard to believe and hard to follow that God who their parent or leader espoused, and yet they were living completely contrary to that in private. How does Esther get to be an Esther? How does a young girl who's plucked out of obscurity and all of a sudden escalated to the highest places with the greatest authority, how does she stand in that moment? Because she was raised by a Mordecai. She was raised by a cousin who stood strong in his faith when tempted, when tried, when put into all these circumstances, who didn't quit being who he was in public or to get along or even when his life was in danger. That's how you end up with an Esther. See, if you want to know where your salvation comes when you're a Mordecai, it comes from the Esther that you raised. But I promise you that you don't get an Esther if you're not a Mordecai. Where's that child supposed to grow up? In whose home is that child supposed to find out what it's like to stand when everything you believe has been put into the test of trust, of faith, when your eyes cannot see and cannot behold your deliverance? You just don't know. When God gives you that child to raise, if they're going to grow up to be an Esther. And they won't. If our faith is up for compromise, up for sale, up for the moment. You see, the problem with situational ethics and things like that is that if you're trying to decide how you're going to react in the moment, then the battle is already lost. Not just in your generation, but in generations to come. See, when the American church laments its situation right now and the cultural setting where we're watching our young people leave the church in great groves, the average person, over 80% of people come to faith in Christ between 4 and 14 years of age. Between 4 and 14. That's the window. 80%. And yet we spend 90 to 100% of all of our resources on the people who are least likely to come. Entertaining adults, trying to keep them interested. Kids ministry gets the leftovers in most cases. How do you end up with an Esther? Can I just tell you, it wasn't by conversion when she was 20 years old or 30 years old. It wasn't conversion while she was in the king's palace. It's what began that was sown in her from the very beginning by a faithful cousin who walked out his faith day by day, even in times of difficulty and persecution. If Mordecai had conducted himself like Haman, there would be no Esther. To be brave in the face of death, to be honorable in the face of dishonorable men, to care in the midst of selfishness. And if Mordecai hadn't trusted God, chances are Esther wouldn't have either. And can I just remind you that Mordecai didn't end up in his situation because he went along with the crowd. Mordecai's life was on the line because he followed after God. We have to get rid of this kind of social gospel thing that says, look, if you just come to Jesus, everything is going to be okay. We sell this gospel that says, look, if you'll just give 10%, then God is going to bless your finances. But what happens when it doesn't? What happens when hardship and financial hard times come to you? If we don't, is it all about getting stuff from God? Is it all about whenever, what if I didn't, did I pray enough? Did I do enough? Did I give enough? Did I show up enough? Did I attend enough? Can I just tell you, that kind of Christianity is bankrupt. It will leave you absolutely morally degenerate. Because there are times in the lives of the heroes of the faith. Turn to Hebrews chapter 11. Dozens of them. We read of their encounters in life in which they absolutely did not see their deliverance come in their day and age. You see, this faith isn't about giving to get. It is very much about us believing who God is in the midst of all of our circumstances and walking with Him regardless of the outcome. You see, the reason I love that quote by C.S. Lewis is he's a dangerous God. Following Him could be really dangerous. Following Him could lead you into the court of Ahasuerus to be judged. Following Him could lead a Haman to want to take your life. But can I just, I just think you might want to know the other part. That without Him, your life might just be every bit as dangerous. Without Him, your life might be every bit as difficult. Without Him, see, there's no guarantee that because you follow Him that your life is going to be dangerous. There's no guarantee that if you don't follow Him that your life isn't going to be dangerous. See, the reality is that life is dangerous. So the question is will you pursue a dangerous God? Are you ready to get dangerous in your faith? Not just for your sake, but for the sake of the children who are growing up in your limelight, the ones who are listening to the way that you talk at the grocery store, the ones who are watching to see if you will walk out your faith in the most difficult of circumstances as well as in the simplest ones. Are you ready to live dangerously? Let's stand together. You know, one of the things as I was getting ready for this morning is I just had this deep sense of, as I was praying for us and asking God what He wanted to do with us this morning. And I just had this really strong sense that, you know, there's a lot of us who, it's not even so much about the trust issue, but it's really a sense that God could never use me. To believe that God can't use you, that the Esthers and the Mordecais of the world are not you. And we have a variety of excuses why God can't use us. For some people, it's really that they think, well, God can't use a rough and tumble person like me. I've heard that said to me so many times on airplanes and in conversations with people. God can't use a rough and tumble person like me. And yet I'm reminded that almost all of the apostles were rough and tumble people. Paul, who persecuted the church. Peter, who couldn't seem to keep his foot out of his mouth except to swing a sword and take somebody's ear off. The Sons of Thunder. How do you get a name like the Sons of Thunder? Don't tell me that they just, you know, like, yeah, I know it was because they liked beans, all right? So, you know, kings like David, who wage war against nations. Judges like Deborah, who defy all the odds. And a woman who goes out to battle when it wasn't common to do so. A man like Samson, who takes on an entire army with a jawbone of a donkey. Prophets like Moses, who were first known for murdering people before they were known for speaking the voice of the Lord. Now, and the enemy tells you, God can't use you. You're not the right sort of person. You're not like those good church people, and God can't use you. Can I just tell you that it takes rough and tumble sort of people to walk out their faith like Mordecai did? On the other hand, I know the enemy loves to lie to people. See, it's his nature. He's a liar and he loves to lie. He lies to all of us. And on the other side of the coin, he's told many of you that you were always the good kid. You always behaved yourself. And the enemy loves to tell you that if you grew up in the church, well, you don't have a testimony. He tells you that you can't relate to the world. that God can't use you because you don't know what the world is like. Do you hear the twisting of the lie? On one hand, you know too much about the world. On the other hand, you don't know enough about the world. And lie after lie after lie, convincing us that God can't use you. But can I just tell you that God uses a good girl like Mary to bring forth the hope of the world. God uses a good boy like the prophet Samuel to challenge the status quo, to raise up kings, to defend the people of Israel. They grew up pure of heart, going to church, so to speak, or going to temple, and God used them powerfully. They have an awesome testimony about the power of God to preserve them and the good work that He began in them. And so regardless of where we stand in this process, here's the thing, is that the question is not, are you able? The question is, are you willing? That's the real question of the morning. Will you trust God in the midst of whatever the circumstances? Will you believe God over against the circumstances as well as in them? Will you lean into Him at a time when you can find all the reasons why you might not want to, because of those people who persecuted, who waged war against your country, of all the people who caused you pain and suffering, whatever might be the reason or the excuses of all the reasons we could give? The question is not can God use you, but will you let Him? Will you trust Him? And so let me just invite you this morning to come and to get some prayer. If you're, whatever the circumstance, whatever your background, history, experience is, that you would say, God, I believe you. I trust you this morning. Now, I know that the restaurants are filling up for Mother's Day. And I know that maybe you've got something on the stove back at home that's cooking and you're worried. But could I ask you for just a moment to just open your heart and trust Him in this very moment, where our concerns, that we just leave those at the feet of the cross for just a moment. Would you pray with me now? And just, Father, I pray right now that for every heart in this room who doubts, who's struggled, wrestled with times where they've thought that you couldn't use them, to believe you, that you have in store for them an epic life. That for some of them, that they are called to just be faithful and patient, walking day by day in what seems like the mundane, that they might raise up a Ruth, an Esther, that they might raise up a child who would know you. Maybe they're just living their lives in such a way so that the neighbors' kids and people around them would recognize the hand of grace and mercy upon them. For others of us, Lord, here today, we're faced with walking through the valley of the shadow of death, and we are afraid of the evil that surrounds us. And we need your courage in the midst of it, to believe that you can use us as we walk through that valley. Even if the valley leads us to great seas, Lord, that we would believe that you're the one who can part the seas, that you're the one who can use us in those moments. God, that when we come to the great mountains, that sometimes we'd not only be joyful to go there to praise you, but we would be grateful to cross those barriers to bring hope and healing to others around us. But God, we pray this morning that you would use us. Use me, O God. Build my faith to trust you in this moment when I cannot see the outcome, when I cannot scroll to the end. Give me courageous faith in the face of difficult circumstances or even the mundane. Help me to walk it out when no one else is looking, because someone always is. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Let me encourage you to come get some prayer this morning before you head out. If you are heading out right away, please, if you would do us the great favor, if you take conversations out into the lobby. Love for you to converse and spend time with one another, but want to leave this space for those who need prayer this morning. God bless you as you go out to love and serve the Lord.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast today. And if you did, there's two things I'd love to ask of you. Number one, would you subscribe to our show? That way, the most recent podcast will be in your feed, ready for you when you are. And secondly, if this ministry has impacted you and you'd like to help us continue to reach others, you can click on the link in the description to give now.